Welcome back. We've returned to our base of Paris this episode for the literary godmother of the 1920s left bank. You've probably heard the name Sylvia Beach in sentences about Hemingway, Joyce, and other famous men. She ended up on the sidelines of many stories as a caretaker and publisher of literature during a high point in the literary scene. But before we get to the avant-garde magazines, her instrumental role in making Ulysses a household name, and her lesbian relationship with the owner of a rival bookstore. Let's start, as always, at the beginning. Despite being back in Paris for this episode, we actually begin in the late 1800s in Baltimore, Maryland. Born to a pastor in May 1887, Sylvia Beach was initially named Nancy after her grandmother, and was the middle child of three girls. Each of the three would change their names as teenagers and adults. Nancy to Sylvia, her older sister Mary to Holly, and her younger sister Eleanor to Cyprian, after several previous changes when said younger sister became a popular film actress in France. But back to their childhood. The family soon moved to New Jersey before Sylvia was a year old, and stayed there long enough for the girls to attend school at the local seminary. There were amateur theatrics, ice skating, and trips around the lake. Yet Sylvia was frail and prone to sickness as a child, and like many ill children, she found solace in books. She was also the middle child, neither burdened with expectations nor the coddled baby of the family. Instead, she became the comedian, developing a quick wit and mastering the art of the comeback.
Now, where have we heard that before for our classic women becoming comedians as children?
It's now a running theme.
Yeah, at this point.
In 1902, the family moved again, this time to Paris to help the minister of a three-year-old American church there, created solely for the U.S. expatriates of the city. Now 15 years old, Sylvia didn't run wild in the city like some of our other podcast subjects. Instead, she remained quite sheltered, perhaps in part because she and her older sister attended school in Switzerland, which was fashionable for Americans overseas at the time. Like others of our women, she ended up rebelling against the strict structure, and her parents allowed her to return to France and sporadic, uneven tutoring for the rest of her education.
It's so interesting how, like, different parents respond in different ways to their children acting out. Some of them just kind of leave them to it. Some of them decide to take them on more outings. Some of them decide, you know, we gotta buckle down and become even more strict. And some of them decide, hey, just come to France.
I await the Excel spreadsheet or board comparing all of our dead women so far on this subject. 3 years after the move, the family and Sylvia returned to the U.S. to Princeton, as her father was assigned to a church there. She did not attend college, if you were wondering.
Yeah, I was going to say, you were like, Princeton? I was like, oh, Princeton. But she wasn't actually going there.
No, women were not in Princeton at the time. Instead, she and her sisters made repeated trips to France and the rest of Europe for months at a time starting in 1907. Sylvia would assist various Princeton professors as a sort of secretary during the times she returned to the U.S., as the Beaches were not rich and travel costs money. By the time World War I engulfed Europe, Sylvia was living in Spain for 2 years, before moving to Paris again in 1916. At which point she knew four languages.
Wait a minute, how did you know four languages?
She picked them up through travel and study.
Wow.
You'd think, with this in hand, she'd get some clerical position with the Red Cross or such for that. But no, that would be her older sister who became a secretary to Major Peck, the chief surgeon of the Roosevelt Hospital unit in France. Instead, after staying with her younger sister, who was at the time at the height of a film career in Paris, Sylvia, at 29, became a volunteer agriculture worker for 2 months in the French countryside while thinking about what to do with her life.
That is so relatable.
She tried her hand at journalism, but there weren't many jobs for women journalists, even in a France devoid of civilian men. Two things altered this situation for her. First, Sylvia arrived back in Paris in 1918. Wandering down a street, she ducked into a bookshop to find out if they had a particular French literary review. Inside, she met the owner, Adrien Monnier. They fell into conversation about French and American literature. They both loved the writing from the other's country. Before leaving with a copy of the review she'd been looking for, Sylvia became a member of Adrian's lending library, which she also ran out of the bookshop. It was supposed to be for a year. It turned into a lifetime. The second thing we will get to after I first go a little bit more in depth into Adrien Monnier, Pixie.
Okay, you know what? I'm fine with that. I'm loving this hint of sapphism.
While the two ended up partners in books and for a time life, they constantly contrasted with each other. Adrien was plump and described in Rabelaisian terms or as looking like a monk or nun. Sylvia was thin and wiry and described as collegiate looking. Adrien was religious and contemplative. Sylvia was agnostic and full of restless energy. Now, for the second thing. Months after this meeting, Sylvia returned for the poetry readings at the bookshop while worrying about what job to get and how to get it. This is not the point at which she opened her famed bookshop, though. Instead, she traveled to Italy and Serbia with her older sister Holly, 2 months after the armistice in November 1918. They stayed 6 months in the latter country and worked as secretaries and translators, though Sylvia was frustrated with the hierarchy of the Red Cross and its demands of obeying orders even if they seemed stupid. It is during this time, in one letter to her parents, that Sylvia admits a desire to get involved with a publishing house or to join a newspaper. The sisters returned to Paris mid-1919, and Sylvia was now determined to open a bookshop in London, for which she asked her mother for financial assistance. Adrien agreed to send books from Paris for the shop. However, it turned out rent was too high, so Sylvia abandoned the idea. But then, in Paris, Adrien found a small shop for her.
Oh, this could get interesting.
Things were not simple here. There was a housing shortage to contend with, and the old lady working concierge at the building, basically like landlord, didn't want to rent to any foreigners. The old lady reluctantly agreed in the end, and Sylvia rushed to find enough books to stock the shop.
Oh yeah, you would need that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, thus, Shakespeare and Company opened in November 1919. She had no idea the number of American expat writers and artists who would flood her shop in the next decade. In fact, she thought only the French customers from Adrien's shop would be regulars. As it would happen, in 6 months, she was known. In 2 years, she was a literary celebrity.
How did that happen? How does a bookshop owner become a celebrity?
Through connections.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is to be seen.
Some people initially called Sylvia Mademoiselle Shakespeare because they got a bit confused as to whether or not the owner's last name was the same as the English dramatist referenced in the shop's title. They eventually got it right. Now, as to being a businesswoman, she would have made MBA graduates shriek in horror. She didn't set out prices on the books. She didn't announce sales. She had no great profits. And she also operated it as a lending library, just as Adrien did hers around the corner.
I mean, also, isn't she getting her, like, support and some of her initial funding from Adrien, another bookstore owner? Like, I know that it is a strategy of bookstores to be near each other so that they can sell different, like, is she selling substantively different works from Adrien?
So it's like twin bookstores. Adrien's is in French. And Sylvia's is in English, focusing on American literature.
Okay, so she at least has that going for her. And I imagine in Paris, it's maybe, you know, not as standard to have an all-English bookstore.
Couple that with the fact it's the 1920s, and the year 1920 specifically opens the floodgates of American expats, beginning with Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas waltzing into the shop. However, as Sylvia noted, Gertrude's subscription was merely a friendly gesture. She took little interest, of course, in any but her own books. Sylvia's shop also became the major distributor for avant-garde magazines in Paris, as regular shops usually refused to carry them.
When we're talking avant-garde magazines, what does this mean?
Think of the different kinds of endeavors that all the expats are coming up with. You have, I think Pound was one who came up with a magazine for a time. I know HG and Breyer and everyone much more involved in England, but who also frequented Paris because of Robert McAlmon. They also are involved in that whole scene. They even do some experimental film stuff.
So there's like poetry in these magazines?
Poetry, short stories, sketches, that sort of thing.
Sounds really cool.
It is also during this time that she met the Irish writer James Joyce, whose work would prove one hell of a challenge for her in the coming years. In 1921, Shakespeare and Company ended up moving to be right across the street from Adrienne's shop. But the real development, according to historians, is Sylvia's decision to publish Joyce's Ulysses. Because she thought he was a great writer and that publishing it would bring fame to her bookshop, along with legitimacy as a publishing body, something that couldn't be done solely with avant-garde magazines.
Yeah, understandably, this is kind of a step up here. We're doing full novels.
Joyce, though, would never give a clear account of whose idea it was. He claimed the credit first before giving it to Sylvia, and then insisted that some other third party suggested it. Either way, the announcement brought a flock of people pre-buying the book before publication even began. And it's before the publication part that I don't think is a thing today, like before they even start printing it or set up to be printed.
Yeah, I don't know. Because you're saying that pre-orders aren't a thing. But also, like, when they set up pre-orders, yeah, it's usually, like, there is a publisher, and they know, like, and the book is finished. Definitely, I don't think that, like, individual bookshops tend to publish books, though. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I know of no modern cases of that, just as I know of no cases before, like, announcing to publish a book before you even have a printer set up or a manuscript in hand.
Yeah, all right, you can delete all this and just say I don't think that's the thing today. you've sold your point.
But without all that, they would get confused.
fair enough.
However, this wasn't the only project Sylvia took on. She also helped the writer Sherwood Anderson communicate with his French publisher, as he spoke no French. She also met the English writer and heiress Breyer, who took a protective interest in the bookshop and provided financial support at various times. In return, Sylvia forwarded all her mail from the bookshop to Switzerland, where Breyer usually could be found living with the American poet H.D. This was to deceive Breyer's mother from ever knowing she wasn't in Paris with her faux husband, Robert McAlmon. Now, as to Adrienne, Sylvia does end up in a relationship with her, but not immediately. Adrienne was with a woman named Suzanne, who married and then died shortly thereafter at the end of 1919.
Ah, so she's going through some rough stuff.
As Gertrude Stein noted, Suzanne's death may have been the catalyst to Adrienne and Sylvia acknowledging that they liked each other. Despite being more reserved than Adrienne, even around other lesbians, Sylvia would also say things like, "My only love was really Adrienne."
That sounds pretty lesbian to me.
It's during the early days of figuring out how to publish Joyce's book that she moved into Adrienne's apartment in perfect illustration of the U-Haul trope.
I mean, their shops are already across from each other. They're already living in a fanfiction, like, I don't know what to tell you.
Now back to Joyce's book. He was a pain with editing. Sylvia would finish getting one proof typed up only for him to add more to a section. There was also the problem of finding a publisher who would print a book that would go on to face an obscenity trial in the U.S.
Ooh, yeah, that was really serious back then.
And because I know you're going to ask, the obscenity charge came from a plotline of a soldier who seduces a girl, gets her pregnant, and ignores her letters ever after like the asshole he was. This was apparently written in rather graphic, for the time, detail. In fact, the old writer Edith Wharton from Natalie Barney's generation called it pornography and threw it away.
Edith Wharton, come on, so many of her stories have, like, sexual undertones to them.
Keyword in your statement, undertones. Now, I still say scandalous for the time, because I've read other books from the 1920s, and they were all very boring by today's standards, despite raising up some scandal at the time of publication. So I think Fifty Shades of Grey it was not, though that book, by all accounts, is also not good.
Yeah, but maybe people don't like it for different reasons than at the time people didn't like Ulysses.
But now, Sylvia does eventually get the printer that Adrienne worked with to do a run, and the initial books went out in 1922. Copies passed through customs in the US and UK before the censors caught on. Sylvia soon had to arrange for smuggling the books in for those people who had pre-ordered it in those countries.
I love this. She is, like, really dedicating herself to publishing this book in all senses of the word.
This publishing turn, though, did not agree with everyone who frequented Shakespeare and Company. Gertrude Stein didn't even wait for her subscription to end before withdrawing. In response to one slight, Sylvia is said to have written, "Yes, a thorn is a thorn is a thorn." She didn't care if Stein disapproved of her actions. The change on Stein's part may have been because she didn't like Joyce's writing. Writers, we're a prickly, wordy, judgy bunch with each other.
I guess.
Now, speaking of Joyce, there was much writing back and forth between Sylvia, him, and the printer over whether Sylvia would be liable for fraud because other bookshops couldn't get rid of their copies of Ulysses. Rather like how no one bought an autobiography of a certain ginger Brit last year.
So, why would it be fraud for her to just be publishing a book?
I suspect because she also did a lot of the marketing, and if the copies didn't sell, a lot of the more business-oriented bookshops, probably while looking to recoup their costs, would try to slap her with charges for fraud, for money, being like, oh, she said this book would actually sell, and it doesn't.
Harsh.
On the possible upside, Sylvia and her bookshop were gaining fame.
Yeah, the notoriety would be coming in because of this whole debacle.
There was an American newspaper who talked of her and her actress sister in January 1923, in fact. Speaking of her sister, Cyprian, the two were in the midst of a quarrel. Her younger sister had failed to make a comeback in French film after a break. Sylvia's growing fame rubbed up against the wound in Cyprian's pride and worsened it. In 1923, Cyprian left Paris for good, telling Sylvia that together they were just miserable. As with Joyce, Sylvia and her friends would adopt other artists whenever they happened to stumble through the door of the bookshop, a pastime that counterbalanced the amount of energy she expended on Joyce himself. The composer George Antheil was one such person. They got him a small stipend from wealthy friends like Breyer, which enabled him to stay in Paris and compose, though he would also go on to write a little verse and prose. Meanwhile, the shop faced competition because of its status. English novelist, critic, and editor Ford Madox Ford tried to undercut her when he announced he would sell books to the same people at cheaper prices and called her notorious for her model of business. There was a bit of a showdown over that while the fifth printing of Ulysses went through. Ford backed down in the end.
As he should. Just because she doesn't know how to run a bookstore doesn't mean that she shouldn't get some credit for all that she's doing.
I wouldn't say she doesn't know how to run a bookstore. She just doesn't maximize her profits.
Okay. She just doesn't put prices on the books?
No, I imagine it's a bit more like haggling.
Okay. So she knows how to run a bookstore in a particular cultural context, I guess.
That, and also it's less selling the books and more a library and sort of hangout for all of the writers.
Okay. I see your point, that she's not about profits or being a bookstore. She's about being a book environment.
Another trick of the trade from Adrienne. It then followed Sylvia and Adrienne translating Hemingway's stuff into French. Sylvia would follow that up with translating Walt Whitman in 1925. So Joyce was not the end of her publishing foray, though he would continue to hit her up for money in the coming years. The man did not appear to be good at budgeting. And while I will say $5,000 or $6,000 in the 1920s went a lot farther than it does today, it's A, not a lot, and B, you really shouldn't be taking so many vacations. I should note somewhere here as well that Sylvia was not good at setting boundaries with customers and writers. She relied on Adrienne to do so, and Adrienne did indeed write a scathing letter to him about his manipulative, fame-seeking ways and his demands on Sylvia.
Good. Good to have someone standing up for you.
As for fun and recreation, Sylvia frequently went on trips with Adrienne, sometimes to visit the rest of the Monnier family outside of Paris. On one trip, they brought Sylvia's dog, and the railway station official said he had to be muzzled. So Adrienne tied her hair ribbon round the dog's jaws, and off they went past the flabbergasted official. Put it on the list of things that you could not do with modern security.
You say that, but have you seen all of the pictures of the New York subway? They made a rule that you can't bring a dog in unless it fits in your bag. And so there's all these pictures of people who have, like, brought in IKEA bags that they've cut out holes for their dog's legs so they can effectively walk them with the IKEA bag as the leash. It's adorable.
I feel like this entire segment should just go on the subreddit r/technicallythetruth.
It probably is already there. It's so good. But yeah, no, like depending on the security, there's definitely different levels. I'm not sure this would fly everywhere, but people have always been and will always be people.
Now, Joyce and his book popped up again in 1926 to 1927, as if this episode is a game of Whack an Irishman. It turns out a Samuel Roth pirated Ulysses in his magazine Two Worlds Monthly.
He just pirated? He just printed it?
Without permission, yes. Now, at the time that she received the news, Sylvia was vacationing in the mountains with Adrienne and would have to wait to return to Paris before filing legal action. During that time, Roth went a step further and announced that he would publish Joyce's next unnamed work, and not Sylvia. Something that surprised both Sylvia and Joyce, who had never talked to this guy about any of it.
Why does he think that because he has pirated something, he can somehow get into Joyce's good favor and publish for him? Like, that makes no sense.
It was a long, drawn-out, dirty fight.
I bet. With this weird guy.
At one point, Roth offered Joyce $1,000, about the equivalent of $17,000 in 2023, for Ulysses, and for Joyce to state that the offer was made and accepted before 1926, when the pirating began.
Wow. What did Joyce have to say about that?
He refused.
Really?
There was a great deal of buying in newspapers by Roth, and Sylvia's responses in other papers getting threatened, and then said papers being afraid of libel suits if they printed her responses. During this, Sylvia's mother died.
So on top of everything she's been dealing with, you know, with this whole nightmare, she has a personal tragedy as well.
And the resulting grief was too much. She asked her lawyer to withdraw her from the Roth suit. Joyce took it as a betrayal. Their business relationship and friendship began to break down after that.
Yeah, understandably. I mean, that sounds like she was dealing with a lot and he was not able to look past it.
The Roth case itself would only be resolved in 1928, by which point it was only about Roth using Joyce's name in the publishing and not, you know, making money off of stolen works.
So wait, did Roth end up, like, paying the money to Joyce and Sylvia?
That will continue to come up.
Okay.
As the 1920s came to a close, many of the Americans left Paris to return to the U.S. as the Great Depression hit even their expat wallets. Sylvia stayed, though this was also the final break with Joyce. As his own suit against Roth drained his finances and he racked up debts, he had legal details to clear up about who owned the book during the filing paperwork. Sylvia as the publisher, or him as the writer.
Oh no.
His growing dislike of women, born of being financially dependent on several for over a decade, plus his failing health only aggravated this exchange. There was also an argument over royalties as sales declined. It's been almost a decade by that point since she published his book, and it went through over 10 printing runs. This was compounded by the legal fight coming to an end with a ruling that anyone was free to publish Ulysses.
I'm sorry, what? This is so wild. We went from, is it fraud to even market this book, to, is it legal to just publish it for free?
It's wild to me. I don't know how any judge ruled that, unless whoever wrote about it just boiled down all the legal details to, the American publishers are allowed to publish it because Sylvia is in France and therefore technically a French publisher, but you should still pay Joyce, only no one's actually following up if anyone's paying Joyce.
Wow.
And this is also the part where I mentioned the whole using Joyce's name. A lot of it boiled down to, if you just remove James Joyce's name from the cover or any indication of who wrote it, then you could publish it.
I'm sorry, what? That is completely bizarre. Like, actually, if you don't attribute this art at all, then it's fine. Oh, man. I mean, U.S. copyright law is currently so messed up, and we all know this, but at least it's not that.
Yeah, thankfully it isn't that. But anyway, back to the whole, who has rights when filing this paperwork?
My favorite game show, who's got the rights now?
Joyce concluded that the main obstacle to any correcting of this situation was to have Sylvia give up all her publishing claims.
Oh, no biggie.
It blew up in a fight that destroyed their friendship. Though she did give up the publishing rights despite the contract they'd both signed over a decade before. For Sylvia, this ended her financial boom and bust cycle around each new print run of the book. The library subscriptions to the shop were also down. Remember, most of the American expats had left at the start of the 1930s. Her translation work kept her afloat, though Adrienne's own shop was the more financially stable one. As the 30s progressed, Sylvia also garnered health troubles with headaches and needing injections of her own blood and calcium, which is a bit odd for a 48-year-old. And before you ask, no, at this point it is not mentioned what is wrong. That will be revealed later, namely in the next year. I will say there is speculation that the headaches at least may be in response to both stress and repressing parts of her personality, including sexuality.
Yeah, that would do it to a person. I mean, also that she lost her mother in this time. I can imagine having a lot of feelings and having to go through a lot of emotional upheaval would also cause some health problems.
1936 brought more troubles. Sylvia returned from visiting her sisters in the U.S. and had to move out of Adrienne's apartment and into the rooms above her own shop. She was now, for the first time, living alone.
Now, why did she have to move out of Adrienne's apartment?
Adrienne's recently acquired friend, Gisele Freund, a Jewish photographer from Germany who had left her homeland for less volatile France, had moved into the apartment while Sylvia was gone, and had also taken up with Adrienne.
So when you say friend, you mean other woman.
Well, to be fair, she did start out as both a friend to Sylvia and Adrienne before Sylvia left to visit her family in the U.S. In letters not long after the move, Sylvia wrote of the wisdom of saving on rent payments, her dislike of the new noise and crowded conditions of Adrienne's apartment, and her displeasure at Gisele. The move was also her idea. Mm-hmm. Sylvia's, that is.
I mean, I could see it being reading the room, though.
Yes, due to the discretion installed in her by her upbringing, though, Sylvia left no documentation on this lover's quarrel. In fact, she only mentions her love life in one cut section, and by section it appears to be one paragraph in her biography.
Please elaborate.
For those curious, Pixie, the paragraph reads, "I think Guide was very much disappointed in me one summer when he joined Adrienne and me at Yerre, and nothing funny ever happened. A lady who attended the American church and used to know my respectable father told someone she would not set foot in my shop where she heard such dreadful things went on."
They're scissoring in the middle of it, like, dreadful things.
"That may have been what was meant about Guide being disappointed nothing funny ever happened. My loves, as any lists may have perceived, were Adrien Monnier and James Joyce and Shakespeare and company. And once I felt so drawn to Robert McAlmont that I wrote him and told him so. But by the time he returned, my 13 generations of clergymen had regained their ascendancy, and to McAlmont's evident relief, we talked only of the weather. Adrienne used to call me Fleur de Presbytère, Flower of the Parsonage. Whether from my Puritan ancestry or Puritanical upbringing. Once, when I was in my early teens, my mother told me, never let a man touch me. I was always physically afraid of men. That is probably why I lived happily so many years with Adrienne."
And it rhymes, so you know it's true.
Sylvia would continue to have dinner with both Giselle and Adrienne in Adrienne's apartment. She would also continue her professional relationship with her ex. Both events continued until Adrienne's death in 1955, though Sylvia, of course, didn't move back into the apartment when Giselle fled as World War II brought the Nazis to Paris. So, Pixie, I think this might be the most amicable breakup and staying friends afterwards that we've had on this podcast.
Or, Rena, maybe just the most repressed one.
Oh, I have a nickname now?
You do now.
Now, aside from her love life, other things were going wrong for Sylvia. She was now receiving radium treatments in addition to a hysterectomy after persistent menstrual bleeding when there should be no blood. The radium treatments sapped her energy for a time, but that wasn't the reason she didn't take opportunities with the Paris Exposition Internationale in 1937. She had a booth there, usually run by her assistant Margaret Newitt. It apparently did quite well, but Sylvia admitted, "I would rather have a nice peanut stand with a machine steaming than try to do something commercial with literature at the exposition."
She knows what the people want.
She certainly does. She joked that her best draw at the event was the sumptuous proportions of her beautiful blonde assistant.
I see.
Unfortunately, her assistant couldn't entice enough business to cover the operating cost of the bookshop, especially with rent and taxes increasing every year since 1922. Many borrowed books, the writer Simone de Beauvoir, borrowed armloads every year while attending the Sorbonne in Paris. But few bought any. Breyer eventually set up a fund to cover Sylvia's expenses, no matter the income of the bookshop. Due to that intervention, Sylvia then sat down to write her memoirs. As she did, Paris was abuzz with talk of war. War in Spain, that is. Sylvia kept track of it for more than just the fight between fascists and communists. Spain had been her home for 2 years before Paris, and she was still emotionally attached to the place. Things only got worse. While Sylvia dealt with fan mail, unsolicited manuscripts, people prowling about for a glimpse of famous visitors, and dwindling actual business, Europe hurtled into World War II. Sylvia stayed in Paris and assured her family that she would be fine with Breyer's funds. As French residents of German origin were rumored to be taken to camps, both Sylvia and Adrienne planned for getting food, character references, and hiding holes for their friends. Several, including Giselle, fled to England or Argentina. Then Shakespeare and Company was forced to close in 1941 when a Nazi officer threatened to confiscate the entire stock of books if Sylvia didn't sell him a copy of Finnegan's Wake, which was published in 1939. There were other instances of Nazi intimidation. Sylvia heard that there was a black mark on her name for having Jewish friends, There was the time the Gestapo pressured her to spy on her neighbors, though that turned out better, as she provided evidence that they were not Jewish, and so they were released.
Well, that turned out well, at least.
Still, the closing of the shop and having to hide all the books when she refused to sell to that officer hurt the most. Thankfully, her landlord didn't charge her rent for the fourth floor apartment after that, so Sylvia wasn't homeless, and more importantly, she could hide the books there.
It's gotta count the small victories in this time period.
Then she was arrested by the Gestapo in 1942. The reason? American nationality. She and other American women were briefly held at the zoo in the Bois de Boulogne before transferred to a converted hotel. Sylvia became postmistress of the internment camp, led a protest against the anti-Semitic views of the president of the camp, and helped the 50 nuns present to care for the sick. After more than 6 months, she was released through the intervention of friends in the Vichy government, though she was given a paper that said the German authorities could rearrest her whenever they wanted. She ended up hiding in a student's hotel run by a friend in Paris after that. Her shop was not released until the fall of 1944, when the Allied forces drove the Germans out of France, though she did not in fact actually reopen the store, despite everyone pleading with her to.
Why not?
After the war, instead of spending all her energy on the bookstore, she volunteered at a hospital and took wounded American GIs on tours of Paris. However, also, Sylvia was now in her late 50s and early 60s. Deaths started arriving in the decade after the war. Her younger sister died in 1951 of cancer of the bladder. Adrienne fell ill with rheumatism, inflammation of the joints, in 1950. Fainting spells followed, and there was talk of her moving back in with Sylvia. By 1954, Adrienne was hit by Meniere's syndrome, a disturbance of the inner ear where, for 9 months after, she suffered auditory delusions of maddening sounds. By June 1955, Adrienne was talking of beating it off this planet. She did, not long after that, though she was first in a coma for a day. Despite having broken up almost 2 decades before, Sylvia was heartbroken at Adrienne's death. As one friend noted, the rest of Sylvia's life was marked by mere honorary awards. One such award was the publication of her own memoirs the next year, 1956. She then sold her Joyce collection to the University of Buffalo in 1958. Then, for 10 weeks in 1959, she gave radio talks, interviews, and lectures when an exhibition occurred of writers in the 1920s. It was also the year that she was given an honorary doctorate of letters from the University of Buffalo as a representative of the best in American and French culture.
And as a wonderful donor of her Joyce collection, I am sure.
Sylvia was physically active till the end. In fact, she broke her wrist while chopping wood in September 1962. Only a month later, she was found dead at age 75 in her apartment of a heart attack that occurred a day or two prior to the discovery. A simple funeral was held at Père Lachaise Cemetery, and she was cremated afterwards. Both groups of her friends, literary and embassy-ish political people, actually sat in embarrassed and overdressed silence during the funeral, as each group thought the other had planned an elaborate ceremony for her.
Wow. This is probably very sad that her funeral isn't as fancy as they wanted it to be, but also it's the second time in her life that her life has resembled a fan fiction, I'm just saying.
Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get a third time.
Yeah, considering she's dead. But it looks like she was very well appreciated.
Yes, but despite the objections of her friends, Sylvia Beach was not buried in Paris. Her ashes were shipped to her elder sister in Connecticut and buried at Princeton the following spring. One friend, on hearing of her death alone, was said to have commented, "She is not alone, then or ever. She had that company around her." Today, if you're ever in Paris, you may come across a small bookstore near Notre Dame if I recall correctly, that has the title Shakespeare and Company over top the door. That is technically the Shakespeare and Company bookshop, but it isn't really connected to Sylvia Beach. It is also not on the same street.
However, from what I saw on Wikipedia, its current owner is named Sylvia.
Yes, in honor of Sylvia Beach.
Nerd.
She is also frequently referenced in books about the 1920s and all the writers, though I don't think she has appeared in any films or TV shows about her friends and customers as of yet.
As of yet, but it sounds like she's a pretty well-acknowledged member of that community.
Thanks for listening. Subscribe on your favorite podcatcher or on YouTube where you can leave a comment and tell us who you would like to hear about next from this circle of dead women, both famous and obscure. We're also on Twitter and we might be on other social media in the future, quite possibly Tumblr, if I can get over having to do more social media. And remember, if James Joyce comes up to you with fire in his eyes and a new manuscript under his arm, think twice before having anything to do with it.